From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Jared Nolan.
And I'm Sam Hirschman.
This week on War News Radio, Afghanistan 2011, we hear about war rugs in Afghanistan.
Then, we hear about the controversies surrounding Basetrack, an experimental media project in southern Afghanistan.
Finally, we explore the story of a shepherd held in Guantanamo Bay through a leaked classified document.
This is War News Radio. From finely woven traditional heirloom carpets to inexpensive war rugs that can resemble blown-up postcards, Afghanistan rug weavers make it all. Then how come no one associates Afghanistan with Oriental rugs? In this analysis of Afghanistan's carpet industry, my co-host Jared Nolan investigates the past history and future challenges facing the country's rug trade. In this piece, first aired in April, he looks into how historical events and traditions have shaped what the industry looks like today. Here's Jared.
When you think of Oriental rug exporters, Afghanistan is probably not the first country that comes to mind. More likely is Iran, Pakistan, India, or Nepal, who all export more rugs than Afghanistan. However, according to the Afghan Carpet Exporters Guild, the carpet industry in Afghanistan employs over 1 million Afghans and produces about 300,000 square meters of carpet annually. That makes carpets the largest official export of the country at $140 million per year, according to a USAID-sponsored study. That's a significant number, but Afghanistan faces many challenges before it can become a major player in the global rug trade. There's a number of reasons Afghanistan has fallen behind other countries in the region. One of the experts in this area is Brian Spooner, professor of anthropology at the University of Pennsylvania and curator for Near Eastern Ethnology at the Penn Museum. I asked him about the history behind the rug trade.
Well, carpet weaving began probably 2,500 years ago and may have begun long before that, but the earliest evidence we...
Let's not go back that far.
Oriental carpets came to be known in the Western world in the late medieval period, and they became prized articles of furnishing.
Closer.
But still, right from the beginning up until 1980, there was never any direct relationship between people who wove the carpets and the consumers in the Western world and then eventually all over the world. And that's what's changed.
What Spooner means is that Afghanistan has always been an isolated country. He said that in recent history it was used as a buffer state between Soviet Russia and Britain's colonial interests to the south. Within the country, there's also been isolation. This is due to the lack of infrastructure throughout the country, few roads and no railroads. Strangely enough, this is a side effect of remaining an independent country.
I mean, areas that came under colonial administrations usually got some benefit from colonial administration, which was some development of infrastructure. But Afghanistan really had no development of infrastructure. And so up until the 1960s, there were essentially no asphalt roads and no railways, and still no railways.
And this lack of infrastructure and isolation has hurt the distribution of Oriental rugs, especially since Afghan carpet production is a cottage industry. According to the Afghan Carpet Exporters Guild, upwards of 95% of weaving is done by families within the home. Middlemen then purchase the unfinished rugs, and most are sent to Pakistan to be finished and then exported to the West. Ali Nejad, president of the Pennsylvania-based Nejad Rugs and an importer of Oriental rugs for 25 years, traveled to Afghanistan in 2007 as part of a delegation coordinated by USAID and the Department of Commerce to explore business and development opportunities. He saw the process firsthand.
Majority of the work is already done by weaving the carpet, but it's like a diamond in rough. And 95% of the carpets that they're being woven over there, it goes back for washing facilities into Pakistan. So due to the fact that they do not have the washing facility there, then they have to send it out to Pakistan. And when it gets to Pakistan, it gets labeled as the Pakistani carpet under the other licensing and all the regulations and importing documentations of the government of Pakistan.
this relationship has been around for a while. One of its main causes was the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979, which disrupted society and displaced thousands of weavers as refugees to Pakistan and elsewhere. This event is a main reason the carpet production in Afghanistan has fallen so far behind. On the bright side, the USAID-sponsored study says that since 2001, over 60% of the displaced carpet weavers have returned to Afghanistan from Pakistan. The Soviet invasion had another curious effect on Oriental rugs in Afghanistan. The breakdown of society left Afghans desperate to earn a living somehow. To make some immediate money, they turned to their rug-making skills.
So they began to try to weave carpets that they could sell immediately to members of the invading forces. And that's when they started to redesign, develop new designs for their carpets instead of the medieval traditional tribal designs. Suddenly they were representing things that had to do with the war that they saw around them in Afghanistan.
These became known as war rugs and include images of modern weapons.
AK-47s.
Tanks.
Helicopter gunships.
Mines.
GIs.
Grenades.
And airplanes.
Guns.
And fighting.
Once the Soviets arrived in Afghanistan, the weavers finally made contact with the consumers of their rugs, and a sort of epiphany moment occurred.
Traditional weavers have suddenly realized that they can change their designs to suit their market and choose their market and adapt their designs for the market that they want to satisfy or the market they want to cater to.
Although produced by the same traditional weavers, war rugs have not been widely accepted among Oriental rug experts and connoisseurs. Nejat appreciates the imagery and the message, but does not stock any for his showrooms. Lately, however, war rugs have become more recognized. Spooner is the curator of an exhibit at the Penn Museum entitled Battleground, War Rugs from Afghanistan. The rugs in the exhibit, on loan from the Textile Museum of Canada, were gradually purchased on eBay. Nonetheless, Spooner was surprised at the variation in quality.
And I should emphasize that the range of quality is much greater than I had originally thought before we got hold of this exhibit. Because up until that time, I had only seen relatively low-quality war rugs. But there are some really high-quality examples as well.
Today, Afghanistan continues to hand-weave both types of carpet. The relatively cheap and inexpensive war rugs that sell directly to soldiers and aid workers stationed in Afghanistan. And also the traditional, flowery oriental carpets that adorn the walls of showrooms thousands of miles away. For War News Radio, I'm Jared Nolan. This is War News Radio. In the last month, WikiLeaks has released nearly 800 classified documents concerning the Guantanamo Bay detention facility in Cuba. The documents provide a candid view into the internal evaluations of Guantanamo detainees. Aaron Moser and Alan Zhao take a look at one detainee in particular. This piece first aired in April.
The document is marked secret and no form, meaning only U.S. citizens with a secret level clearance can view the document. It is dated June 3, 2005. His name is simply Charbot. He was born on New Year's Day, 1973, making him 30 when he was picked up in 2003. Place of birth, Cairo Village, Stalbar District, Khost Province, Afghanistan. Charbot and his family are nomadic shepherds and move around in search of prime grazing grounds. He is married with one daughter and three sons. He also has 300 goats, 5 sheep, 8 camels, and 2 baby camels. His internment number is 1051, and he has been held in Guantanamo Bay for approximately a year and a half. The evidence against him is meager.
Detainee was arrested because he was suspected of aiding his brother, Qatar in an IED attack against an Operation Detachment Alpha 332 patrol. Qatar was captured about 500 meters from the IED detonation site as he was running away. The detainee has consistently denied that he aided his brother or had any involvement with the attack. To date, there is still no information associating detainee with this attack.
Any former assessment of Sharbat as a terrorist seems to be based on his proximity to the blast and his hesitation in admitting his relation to his brother.
Detainee denied any knowledge of the IED blast. He did not recognize his brother, Qatar, until after Qatar identified a digital photograph of the detainee.
The report goes on to describe his brother, Qatar, as a likely member of the anti-coalition militia.
Qatar was arrested immediately after an IED attack on Operation Detachment Alpha 332 patrol. Qatar was spotted on the high ground overlooking the road. He was spotted by Afghan military forces running away and refused to halt when ordered. Qatar was found in possession of a set of binoculars. Under questioning, Qatar gave names of remote bomb distributors, technicians, and transporters. Qatar has knowledge of IED financing and leadership hierarchy.
On November 21, 2003, Sharbat was transferred from Bagram Air Force Base, his original holding facility, to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. His reasons for transfer lay in his potential intelligence value.
Reasons for transfer to Gitmo. Specific information concerning anti-coalition militant activities to destabilize coalition and Afghanistan government reconstruction efforts in Khoust Province, Afghanistan. Improvised explosive devices. Ingress-egress from Afghanistan and Pakistan.
However, the report illustrates a Sharbat decisively unable to provide this high-level intelligence. Sharbat is noted to be illiterate and lacking military experience and weapons training. Sharbat never altered his story in his 19 interrogations at Bagram Air Force Base. Also noted is that three Bagram interrogation teams recommended his release, though no explanation is given as to why these recommendations were not heeded. Unclassified Administrative Review Board transcripts show that Qatar, the suspected leader of the two, was released in Afghanistan, while Sharbat was sent to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. At Guantanamo, Sharbat was interrogated a further 6 times. These interrogations did not produce new intelligence on suspected IED activity, but instead revealed a simple shepherd.
During an interview on June 13, 2004, the interpreter stated the detainee uses tribal dialect and appears to be very uneducated. Detainee went on to explain in detail how he shepherded. Analyst note, this detainee's knowledge of herding animals, which he readily talks about, and his inability to discuss simple military and political concepts, tend to support the detainee's contention that he indeed is just a simple shepherd. After the June 13th interview, the debriefer acknowledged that the detainee appears to be what he claims to be, a shepherd. His involvement in the Taliban or anti-coalition militia is undetermined. In any case, it appears he would be a soldier type, and certainly not of any notoriety or travel in leadership circles.
Another interview conducted by a federal law enforcement agency over a year earlier came to similar conclusions about Sharbat's importance.
Subject is cooperative, but it does not appear that he is being 100% truthful. I believe that the subject is afraid that by giving names he will be found guilty of something. However, it is not likely that further interview or interrogation would produce any further information relevant to law enforcement activities. For law enforcement purposes, I do not believe this subject should be transferred to Gitmo.
For these reasons, Sharbat is labeled as low in terms of both detainee threat level and intelligence level. The report's recommendation for him is as follows.
Recommendation. Joint Task Force Guantanamo recommend detainee is released or transferred to the control of another country.
This recommendation was made on June 3, 2005. On February 8, 2006, Sharbat was released to Afghanistan. He had spent nearly 3 years under American captivity. His 25 formal interrogations had gleaned no useful information. Today, Guantanamo remains open with 172 prisoners. How many of them have stories like Sharbat? For War News Radio with Aaron Moser, I'm Alan Zhao.
This is War News Radio. Whether or not you have a loved one in the military, it's difficult to imagine the daily reality for soldiers currently serving in the longest war in American history. BaseTrack, an experimental media group, has been on the ground with one United States Marine Corps battalion at a base in southern Afghanistan, but was shut down by the USMC and asked to leave. Eliana Biskar Church has more in this piece, first aired in February.
If you go to BaseTrack's Facebook page, you can meet Americans with an active investment in the war in Afghanistan. Posts from people debating the causes of the Afghan insurgency, or the WikiLeaks phenomenon, are sandwiched between posts from mothers and fathers wondering how their sons are doing. Jeff Johnson, whose son is a supply officer currently in Afghanistan, is an avid follower of BaseTrack.org and comments on its Facebook page daily.
I read many of the things that the wives and the mothers and the other family members put out there, and it gives you a perspective of, you know, my son's not really in combat, but those people, their children or their spouses are, you know, out in the field dodging bullets, and it's all out there. You can feel their anxiety. I think in that way it connects me with them.
The Facebook comments have recently centered on one topic, though, that BaseTrack, an experimental media project following the 1st Battalion, 8th Marines, or 1-8, received a letter from a public affairs officer informing them that they are, quote, being asked to leave 1-8's positions due to perceived operational security violations on portions of their website, end quote. The journalists are not formally disembedded, which would require proven security violations, but the letter specifically noted BaseTrack's use of Google Maps on their website. BaseTrack's founder, Chiru Kueyama, says that they have specifically altered the map points to be non-targetable. Uncertain about the letter's language and reasoning, Kueyama has attempted to contact public affairs, but has been unsuccessful.
The letter from the public affairs officers was certainly a surprise, saying that there was operational security violations with the BaseTrack.org website, and that the Marine Battalion didn't have the manpower or the logistical capability to accommodate us for the next few weeks. So I basically had different camps saying totally different things. It was very unclear who any of it was coming from, and my immediate response when I get this letter saying there's an OPSEC violation is to write back and say, hey, if there's an OPSEC violation, you know, let's work together and deal with it so that nobody's life is endangered, but no response at all to that. So it was really confusing.
Kueyama believes that there are other motives in place.
The most recent correspondence that I've gotten from the head of public affairs of the Marine Corps in Afghanistan is that there's no OPSEC violation. They've, you know, repeatedly said that the project has been overwhelmingly popular, and that everybody that we've worked with in the military seems to like us a lot. So my gut feeling is that someone in the Pentagon saw the BaseTrack site and really wigged out, and it's not hard for me to believe that somebody, especially maybe, you know, an older Marine, a very senior one, thought that there was an OPSEC violation, or looks at a computer screen and sees some technology that they don't really get, but they'd much rather have it just go away.
BaseTrack certainly has made an impact online. Through art, personal reflections, photos, and other media, BaseTrack has strived to connect Americans with loved ones in the service. BaseTrack's Matt Farwell wanted to bring the stories home.
The goal was to connect the families. That was one of the goals. The goal was to bring some sort of emotional connection to Americans who you know, just kind of see the war on TV and then wonder, okay, yeah, Afghanistan war and American Idol, let's see. Okay, American Idol, right? And that's about the same level of engagement they have with it to give them some sort of gut investment in it next time they go into a ballot box or go call their congressman or do whatever they do. And we're not trying to tell them how to think or what to think. We're just trying to tell them to think.
Basetrack is an extremely diverse group, with members from New York to San Francisco to Hungary to Pakistan. Jeff Johnson likes the mix.
The diversity of the group of people that are involved in the media, for instance, the retired Army gentleman, Matt Farwell, you know, he gives you a perspective from the military side. The rest of them have other media backgrounds, which gives them very diverse perspectives.
Johnson says the mix of media matters as well.
To me, it's the diversity of the different media types that make the site. You know, you can see pictures, but you can also see videos, and it's very interesting to hear these young Marines that are putting themselves in harm's way, and to see and hear them. The other things that I'm really interested in are the links in the articles that the Basetrack people connect you with to read about all aspects of the war.
Farwell is the only member with military experience. He was a U.S. Army soldier from 2005 to 2010 and served 16 months in Afghanistan during 2006 and 2007, which he says was one of the heaviest points in the conflict. He has been writing of the effects of war on returning soldiers based on personal experience.
War is a terrible thing. You go and you kill people, and people try and kill you. And that's if you're actually a frontline, on-the-ground soldier. And then there are people that are outside every day, sleeping in mud, living a pretty brutal, nasty life. Since being back, I've had a rough time. But, you know, it's something that people need to be aware of before they really glorify and, you know, seek to label everyone a hero. That's part of what I'm trying to do, is say that, you know, the responsibility of the American citizen doesn't end with the clap and the yellow ribbon.
In addition to informing their audiences, Basetrack members have also helped Marines more directly at times.
Obviously, we can't accommodate everybody as much as we'd like to, but if it's possible and if we can, you know, we'll say, hey, Private so-and-so, your mom says hi, or to one of the moms that your son looks good, you know, he's dirty, and but that's the way he likes it, or, you know, something like that. So a bit more of a connection that way, and a bit more of an intimate connection that way.
Farwell says resources available through Basetrack's different pages have excited its followers.
I mean, I've been blown away by the nuanced level of discussion, intelligent comments, and, you know, back and forth of these people that have not only great emotional investment in what's going on over there, but often, you know, a completely, like, different perspective. You know, you have mothers and grandmothers and wives and sisters and brothers and veterans and, you know, everything. You really get a good perspective that I don't think you find anywhere else.
Responses to Basetrack have been supportive and enthusiastic.
Personal responses, I've gotten quite a few, and I've developed, you know, quite a few online friendships with some of the family members and followers that just want to know a little bit more about what's going on and kind of what their sons or their family members or whoever's over there might be going through. And so I kind of share my experience, and especially my experience after coming back.
Connecting with family members speaks to the strength of the project, which has created a phenomenon Kuwayama believes will allow Basetrack to continue.
One of the core concepts
concepts of the project, I think bore out, which was that we weren't just embedding with the Marines themselves in Afghanistan. We were embedding with their families in a virtual space. In our case, we have a timed audience, but they're actually all, they're the families of the Marines that we're embedded with. And I mean, ultimately when this whole thing was going down and people were telling us that we were being ejected, you know, my response is always, you do whatever you have to do. You don't have to explain anything to me. You have to explain it to the wives and mothers and the families of 1,000 Marines. If you can do that, you're home free.
Johnson has enjoyed being able to see more of what the Marines are doing, but he was not very surprised at the news of the cancellation.
No, I was a little bit surprised until I sat back and considered everything, and I thought, well, this event isn't all that surprising. Some of the families are devastated because it's going off the air, but I don't think it's the end of the concept.
It's done a lot of good. These other family members that are on here are just so grateful to BaseTrack. I hear them, or I see their comments. They're so grateful to BaseTrack to be in touch with their family.
The BaseTrack team will not give up easily. Next, they plan to distribute the remaining 1-8 content and plan new projects.
Once we get through this, we're back full steam to doing the thing that we set out here to do, which is actually to share photos and reports reporting with these Marine families. It doesn't look like we're going to be invited back into our previously scheduled embed, but you know, fundamentally, that's not remotely the end of the project, because in a lot of ways, the center of gravity with the project isn't actually in Afghanistan. It's in Facebook, or it's in Twitter, or it's virtual. It's the families of these Marines, not the Marines themselves. So that all continues. And right now, I've got something like half a dozen people floating around Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the United Arab Emirates, waiting to see where to go next. And there's definitely a lot of stuff happening out there. So I think that's where the project goes. We're still on the ground in Afghanistan, and I think wherever we go in Afghanistan, we're taking the families of 1,000 Marines with us.
War News Radio attempted to call the Marine Corps public affairs officer who signed the letter, which BaseTrack has published, but the phone number he provided seemed to be out of order. Though BaseTrack has not yet announced any new specifics, they have already made an impact and expect to continue to do so. You can follow them on Facebook or at basetrack.org. For War News Radio, I'm Eliana Biscard Church.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our producer is Jim McMillan. And I'm Jared Nolan.
I'm Sam Hirschman. Until next time, thanks for listening.